real famine is coming, and it's all by design. And welcome to the special report. I'm Mike Adams. I've been warning about this for many years. I've covered the long timetable of human depopulation agendas being run by governments and pushed by NGOs and globalists like Bill Gates, etc., and how it weaves its way through various programs, including vaccines, pesticides, herbicides, global warming, climate change, COVID, and now the war in the Middle East. It's important to note that about one-third of all fertilizers sail through the Strait of Hormuz normally, and I didn't even realize it was that high. I thought it was only maybe 25%. But the seaborne fertilizer trade for our planet, about a third of that goes through the Strait of Hormuz. Now, there are land routes that are different, but they're nowhere near as large. So this is a significant portion of the world's fertilizer. And of course, that's been shut off now for almost 8 weeks. This is a crisis. This is a, even if you can manage the lack of oil and natural gas and helium and sulfuric acid and all these other things, fertilizer is a critical issue. And I think that's one of the reasons why this is staying in place. And it's a pretty good bet that the Strait of Hormuz is going to stay closed for months. It's not going to open back up next week, no matter what Trump says or tweets or what the White House says. It looks like they're going to keep this shut down for many months, and the food crisis is going to get far worse. Now, China, of course, knows what's coming. China is always challenged to feed its roughly 1.3 plus billion people. So last month, in March, they suspended the export of their nitrogen-potassium blends of fertilizer plus phosphate fertilizers, almost all NPK blends, etc. So that's done. And a lot of countries that used to import from China are having to find other sources or pay a lot more or go without. At the same time, Russia, which also normally exports a large amount of fertilizer such as ammonium nitrate, that's been halted. And maybe it's going to resume, maybe not. But globally, the spot price for urea has doubled since February to about $900 per metric ton. And that could go, again, much higher. The longer the strait stays closed, the worse this gets. So I asked AI agents to do some research for me. I said, I want you to find which countries are at the highest risk from these famine-related events. So I want to know which countries are heavily dependent on fertilizer imports through the Strait of Hormuz, through Persian Gulf imports. I want to know also which countries have a very high share of household income that they spend on food, thus meaning they have very little buffer to be able to pay more. I also want to know which countries have a pre-existing food insecurity issue or any kind of an active conflict that could add chaos to this formula. And then which countries have weak fiscal capacity to be able to absorb anything like subsidy costs for food, and also destabilize governments that would make this whole situation worse. So those are my criteria. And then I unleashed some AI agents to go do the research, and here's what it found. First, it reminded me that there are fertilizer plants in countries like India and Pakistan and Egypt that produce fertilizer domestically, but they depend on natural gas as the feedstock, which, of course, makes sense. We're talking about the Haber-Bosch process, right? Urea or ammonia first. And that natural gas, of course, comes from Qatar, mostly from Qatar Energy, which has already declared force majeure. So there you go. No more feedstock of natural gas means no more fertilizer. And that also impacts Bangladesh and Egypt. Did I say Egypt? Yeah, okay. So many of the fertilizer plants in Bangladesh have already closed down. And Egypt used to get gas from Israel, but that's no longer functioning for political reasons. So Egypt is buying natural gas on spot market. You can imagine what's happening to those prices. Now, phosphate fertilizer production, in case you maybe never knew the chemistry here, and it's a good reminder for all of us, depends on sulfur. You got to have sulfur, and you have to have sulfuric acid in order to produce phosphate fertilizer. Well, about half of the sulfur comes out of the Strait of Hormuz in terms of seaborne trade. So without sulfur, you know, again, you have to have that as an input. So even if you have a fertilizer plant somewhere, if you don't have sulfur, you know, you can't make phosphate fertilizer. So there's a cascade of domino effect, force majeure, invocations. This is affecting the entire supply chain. And it's worsened by the fact that China and Russia are restricting their exports to countries that most desperately need it. Basically, right now, you know, China is saying, well, it's every man for himself, you know. India even went to China or asked China for some help. Like, hey, we need some of the fertilizer exports. And China said no, probably because India typically sides with the West, you know, instead of doing business with China. So China told India to go pound sand, and India has to feed also 1.3 billion people, or what is it, 1.4 billion people almost by now? Who can keep track? So we're in a crisis that's just beginning. The food stocks that were grown in the last growing season are pretty much, you know, at the end of their pipeline, let's say. I mean, maybe a couple more months, and we're sort of eating last year's food, etc., at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. And then in the Southern Hemisphere, you're going to see big problems forming up, you know, after the summer. After our summer in the North, let's say August timeframe. That's when it's going to start hitting the Southern Hemisphere for their planting season. Now, farming depends a lot on credit, of course. And farmers, especially in places like India or Egypt, you know, they're not the wealthy people in society, and it's very difficult for them to get credit to purchase fertilizer. And so there's not really a lot of funding available for buying fertilizer at double or triple the price, which means that a lot of crops are going to be planted without fertilizer, or in some cases, they won't be planted at all. And without these fertilizers, crop yields will, of course, drastically fall, depending on the crop. You know, corn is impacted probably more than anything else, but rice is also heavily impacted, etc. Legumes, not so much, you know, depends on the crop. But corn, forget it. You don't fertilize corn, you just don't get much corn at all. So even if you plant and all your fuel inputs are still the same and all your equipment costs are the same and all your labor costs are the same, you just don't get the yields that you used to get. And this will contribute to global famine. So let's talk about the FAO says that if you have a 10% reduction in fertilizer, then your rice, corn, and wheat yields plummet by 25% or up to 25%, citing the fact that, quote, nutrient response curves are nonlinear, which, you know what that means. Yeah. Again, you know, you cut fertilizer by 50%, your crop yields can plummet a lot more than 50%. That's what that means. It's nonlinear. So you need every drop of fertilizer that you can get, or every granule, and that's just not available now. So yes, famine is coming. So I'm going to go through the countries now that are about to be impacted the most. And most of them have something in common. They're countries populated by black people. And the history of depopulation agendas carried out by Western nations has repeatedly targeted Africa. For example, there were depopulation chemicals put into vaccines that were given in Kenya. That blew up as a giant conspiracy that turned out to be true. You know, efforts to focus abortion centers in black neighborhoods in America, for example. There are many examples. I'm too many to go into, but what the Western world or Western globalists, what they have often wanted to do is really suppress populations of black people, both in the United States and also in Africa. And this engineered famine is going to hit African nations harder than anything we've ever seen. And literally, easily, hundreds of millions could die in Africa if the situation continues to worsen. So the number one country that's going to be impacted by this in the world is Sudan. Sudan is a country of over 50 million people. So it's, you know, it's about half the size of Iran in terms of population, or a little more than half. It's already classified by the IPC as a phase 5 famine condition country. 22 million people need food assistance just to keep them alive in Sudan right now. That's almost half the population. Their planting season is June and July, and the harvest is October, November. Do you think they're going to get fertilizer by June? Probably not. No. Half of their fertilizer comes from the Persian Gulf. So they grow a lot of sorghum and wheat. The famine risk of Sudan is very real because the country is essentially already in a state of famine, just barely being staved off by emergency food rescue supplies every year, recent years anyway, for almost half the population. So we're talking about a mass die-off in Sudan from late 2026 through 2027. Mass starvation. You're going to see the photos. You're going to see the calls for help. You're going to see the appeal to, you know, wealthy nations, send food. It's going to get bad. That's already baked in. I don't think there's any way to stop that from happening, unfortunately. The next country that's subject to a similar situation is Yemen. That's right, Yemen, where the Houthis are. In Yemen, and I don't have the population numbers for Yemen, but I know that 18 million people are already in a phase 3 of famine because of their economic situation, which is not good. Almost all of the food and fertilizer consumed in Yemen is imported. And, of course, the Red Sea routes are critical to that. But the Houthis there are, you know, engaged in operations to disrupt shipping in the Red Sea through the, what's it called, the Bab el-Mandeb. Is that the right name for that strait right there at the opening of the Red Sea? We all got to get more familiar with the vocabulary here. That could mean that the ships, even if there is fertilizer available, that the ships can't necessarily make it through that strait, you know, because of the ongoing war. And remember, the Houthis are disrupting ships that are tied to Western nations like the United States and UK and Israel because of Israel's genocide against Gaza and the Palestinians. So the Houthi action has been going on for a long time. I mean, years now, and it's not even related to the war in the Persian Gulf. Although it might become related to that. They might work in unison with Iran. At least that's what's being reported. So Yemen itself is going to face mass starvation if this situation continues. The next country facing famine is Somalia. According to the research, about 6.5 million Somalis are already in phase 3 of famine or higher. There was a bad drought in 2025 that continues to reverberate through their food supply scarcity. They import nearly all of the fertilizer that they use, and commodity prices are already rising in Somalia. So we're going to start seeing famine in Somalia later this year, probably beginning in September timeframe, and then also extending into 2027 as well. So not good, right? So those are the worst countries, Sudan, Yemen, Somalia. Those are the three worst in terms of projected famine. Now, in addition to those three, there are high vulnerability countries like Ethiopia that gets over 90% of its fertilizer from the Persian Gulf. Its planting season is June and July. They're facing massive fertilizer shortfalls. The effects on the diet there, the starvation, will begin to be felt from October onward, and then peaking all the way through spring and summer of 2027. Bangladesh imports about one-third of its fertilizers and most of its urea from Saudi Arabia. Domestic production, remember, it has its own fertilizer facilities, but they require natural gas. So even when its own fertilizer plants are running, it only covers less than one-third of domestic demand. So without the gas and without the fertilizer imports, Bangladesh is going to face acute exposure to crop failure during the Boro rice season, which is normally transplanted, I'm reading here, December through February, and it's harvested April and May. So that is the country's largest crop by far, which means that if there's not ample fertilizer by the time the end of this year rolls around, then Bangladesh will face extreme famine all of 2027, or beginning in, let's say, roughly the summer of 2027, if they have food supplies to make it that far. Importantly, in Bangladesh, the spending on food is a very high percentage of household spending. It's about 40 to 50% of household spending for the bottom income earners, like the lower 20%. So this could easily trigger unrest in countries like Bangladesh. Another country that's going to be strongly impacted is Sri Lanka. Now, by the way, let me remind you that everybody in the world understands that this is Trump's fault. They're going to point the finger right at Trump because Trump started the war by choice. He didn't have to. Iran didn't attack the USA. This was a war of choice. This was a war because, well, Trump wanted to do the bidding of Israel. So Trump started the war. And it's Trump's actions that are thrusting all of these countries into famine, which isn't being felt yet. But boy, what's coming is going to be absolutely tragic. Now, Sri Lanka in particular, you may recall back in 2021, the government banned the importation of synthetic fertilizers. And it caused a total crop collapse and an economic crisis. And the people burned government buildings. And then the president was removed from office. So that was a bad experiment. Like, what happens if we don't use fertilizer? Everything burns down, it turns out. So people are not gonna treat the government nicely in Sri Lanka if they can't get fertilizer. Now, they eat a lot of rice in Sri Lanka, of course, and they're currently harvesting some rice, and hopefully that will go well. But it's going to run out, of course, if the Strait of Hormuz stays closed. Now then, there's Pakistan. And in Pakistan, about 7.5 million people are already in food crisis. Some of that's due to a monsoon flooding event of 2025. And then there's persistent drought and so on. So like many of these countries I've mentioned, Pakistan does have a fertilizer production plant, but it needs natural gas in order for that plant to function. And of course, nobody's getting natural gas now, or I should say the supplies are extremely scarce at the moment and very expensive. Egypt is the world's largest importer of wheat. Did you know that? Yeah, 10 million tons annually. Wow. And the government of Egypt runs a bread program that feeds about 70 million people. You know, like a food stamp type of program. So the government buys a massive amount of wheat, and it makes the bread and hands out the bread. Egypt has its own fertilizer industry, but it needs gas in order to do it. And of course, the LNG prices are skyrocketing. Right now, the wheat harvest is in progress in Egypt. So it will be okay for the summer of this year and into the fall. But if you get into late year And then into next year, if Egypt doesn't have access to gas and fertilizer imports, you could see civil unrest. In fact, this has been part of the history of Egypt, is when bread prices went insane, the Egyptians took to the streets. They started marching on the government. So that could happen as well. You might end up with price controls, probably, because that's what Egyptian governments do. And you're going to have price controls, which is going to lead to black markets and all kinds of bad ideas, bad economics combined with real famine. So Egypt is going to be impacted in a bad way. Nigeria has the largest population of near-starvation people in the world. It's 27 million people that are categorized as IPC phase 3 or higher. And that's a category of, you know, food insecurity. So 27 million people, that's a lot of people who don't have enough to eat. So Nigeria has its own fertilizer production, but of course it's subject to natural gas imports, either pipelines or by ship. If Nigeria faces real food scarcity and higher food prices, it's one of those countries with a lot of potential political instability that could, and this could just be the, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, or the trigger for real social unrest. There's a similar situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DR Congo, which I'm also remembering that Congo is where I think a large part of the world's cobalt comes from, that's used in lithium ion battery chemistry for EVs and such. Plus, there's also a fair amount of cacao that comes out of DR Congo. Yeah, that's true. But 26.7 million people are in food crisis there in Nigeria, which is massive. The planting season runs September through November, which means that the real famine will probably hit DR Congo in 2027. All right, so those countries, those were kind of the second tier countries that are going to face very serious situations, including potential famine. Now there's a third tier that have better stockpiles, better buffers, more stable, but they will still be impacted. And I'll go through those quickly. That includes India, Turkey, Brazil, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. So, you know, food inflation is going to happen there. There's going to be a lot of unhappy people, but they're probably not going to have mass die-offs, whereas some of the earlier countries that I mentioned could see real starvation, like Sudan and Yemen and Somalia, etc., Ethiopia. It's going to get bad. So you're going to start seeing, you know, food aid concerts in America in 2027 that are going to pretend like they're raising money to send to Africa, but they never do. They actually just squirrel it away and stuff the pockets of the concert organizers who lie to everybody and take the money and run. There's a prediction for you. It's going to be 100% accurate. You can count on that. Now, David Dubin has, you know, who I've interviewed numerous times, has good information in this area. Michael Yon talks about the engineered famine. But David Dubin has a lot of experience in Southeast Asia, and I think he knows the growing seasons better and the predominant local crops and so on. So I will reach out to David and Michael and people like Matt Bracken and others, and you know, we'll keep you informed as this is happening. But here's the situation. If the Strait of Hormuz were to reopen right now, then probably we would avoid the worst impacts of everything I've laid out for you here. We might not see millions of people starve if the Strait reopens right now. But that seems incredibly unlikely for the simple reason that the U.S. and Iran have contradictory goals. Iran, existentially, needs to assert control over the Strait of Hormuz for its own political protection and also monetary recuperation from war damage. Whereas the United States cannot, or at least Trump's ego cannot, allow Iran to assert control over this waterway which would allow Iran to charge tolls. And Trump just can't allow, he can't stand to see somebody else making money if he doesn't get a piece of it, it seems. So it seems very unlikely, at least at the moment, that there's going to be any kind of a peace deal. There may be peace deals announced, especially by Trump or the White House, which has repeatedly, I think Trump has claimed 35 times that Iran has been completely defeated and completely destroyed. He's been wrong all 35 times. So if he announces number 36, don't believe it. It's just, he's just saying those things to manipulate the markets, obviously. And the U.S. Navy is nowhere near the Strait of Hormuz. They don't dare approach. So the Navy doesn't control the Strait. Iran controls the Strait. It's obvious every single day. If normal traffic doesn't return to the Strait of Hormuz, which would be something like 120 to 130 ships a day passing through the Strait, if that doesn't return to normal within the next few months, let's say 3 or 4 months, or maybe even less than that, then we get into guaranteed famine in late 2026 and throughout 2027, as I've laid out here. Guaranteed. And even in countries like the United States and Canada, where probably you're not going to see millions of people starving, but you're going to see many millions, tens of millions of people struggling with food costs or food insecurity, as it's often called by the NGOs. They won't be able to afford to eat, at least not like they used to. Maybe they'll have to buy like a bag of potatoes, you know. Might not be a bad idea for some Americans to learn how to cook instead of buying everything from Uber Eats. You know, buy some rice and potatoes and a chicken. You know, make yourself your own soup or figure it out. You know, you don't have to buy everything that's just prepackaged, pre-made, fast food. You know, when I grew up, we didn't buy processed food all day long. We made our own food. We made our own chili. We made our own soup. We made our own whatever, you know. So maybe more Americans are going to have to figure that out. More Americans are maybe going to grow some food and maybe have some backyard chickens, which I have. I get fresh eggs every day. It's awesome. And some days you have to look for, where did they lay the eggs today? I found a new spot recently in one of the hay bales. And it's like, oh, there's like a dozen eggs in this one spot because obviously the hen had been laying there for a while. So anyway, it's like Easter every day. You get to find the eggs. Things are going to change for a lot of Americans, and it's going to be, you know, politically very damaging to the GOP and to Trump himself, obviously, if the closure of the Strait of Hormuz continues for a few more months. It'll be devastating for the midterms. Not only will fuel prices go much higher, but also, of course, food prices as well. So that's the reality of the situation. Bottom line, American people probably not going to starve to death, not in very high numbers, maybe not at all. But it's going to suck. You're going to pay a lot more for food. You're not going to be able to afford the food that you used to buy, or many Americans won't. But for countries in, you know, in Africa, Sudan, and even we talked about Egypt, and even India, even Bangladesh, right? These countries are going to be hit hard. And there you will see mass famine and starvation throughout 2027 if the situation doesn't get resolved. So some people think that's the plan. And maybe I think that too. I don't know. I mean, clearly there's a global human extermination plan underway. Is this war part of that plan? Yeah, very, very likely. Or maybe human extermination is one of the globalists' perceived, quote, benefits of the war. It's like, oh, we get the war and we get to, you know, exterminate a billion people or whatever. Like, in their minds, because they're so evil and anti-human, that would be a bonus. So maybe that's what's happening. In any case, you need to be prepared. And so get your own food supplies. You can get them from us, of course, healthrangerstore.com. Lab-tested, certified, organic, long-term, storable foods, you know, tested for glyphosate, heavy metals, atrazine, all kinds of stuff. We test for dioxins now, too. Did you know that? So check it out, healthrangerstore.com. And then in order to get ready for the economic collapse scenarios, make sure you've got backup communications. I want to give credit to our sponsor, the Satellite Phone Store, SAT123.com. And they've got satellite phones and solar generators and solar panels and Faraday bags and a whole lot more. So check them out and they can help you get prepared for the difficult times that are coming. But hey, at least the good news is the difficulty that we will experience in North America is nothing compared to the difficulty of being in some of these countries I just mentioned. It's going to get crazy. It's going to get dangerous in a lot of these other countries. And I don't know. I sure do hope that we can find peace and that the Strait of Hormuz opens again. I hope Trump can just swallow his pride and back off, walk away. Let Iran charge tolls. It's worth it. It's worth it. Why not have them collect $1 million per ship for every tanker that rolls through there? The ship's carrying, like, you know, billions of dollars of economic productivity potential. So, you know, who cares if they have to pay $1 million? Iran is right there. I mean, they're on the whole north shore of the strait. You're not going to be able to control the strait unless you somehow destroy the entire Persian civilization, which has not happened in, what, 5,000 plus years of history and all the attempts throughout history that were tried and failed. Come on. You're not going to be able to destroy Persia, especially since the U.S. military is practically run out of ammo or is close to it. So, you know, find some agreement, shake hands, sign a deal, get us out of there, bring our soldiers home, and let people grow food, okay? That's the answer for humanity. Every day that this strait stays closed, because Trump wants it closed, is a day that, projected into the near future, potentially maybe hundreds of thousands of people will die. Every day, the clock is ticking. And human populations are at stake. So join me in praying for peace, and thank you for listening today. I'm Mike Adams. You can follow my work at brightvideos.com and my articles at naturalnews.com. And you can follow my social media posts at brighteon.social. So thank you for listening. Take care. We are entering the eighth week of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, an event that, whether this is the intention or not, will result in famine in various countries around the world, but notably African nations. And I have a separate report on that, but I want to point out something to you here that's rather shocking, and it's how any talk of human depopulation is instantly characterized by search engines and AI engines as a conspiracy. So it's a depopulation conspiracy. And yet, I want to quote from you a 1969 New York Times article. The title is, "A Sterility Drug in Food is Hinted." And the article was written by Gladwin Hill. And if you ask AI about this particular article, and for example, I asked Claude about it, it will tell you all about the depopulation agenda. And then it will say, but it's a conspiracy theory. So let me read for you what Claude, this is from Anthropic, what Claude says about that article from 1969 in the New York Times. It says, well, I already read you the headline, the sterility drug. Subhead, biologist stresses need to curb population growth. By Gladwin Hill, November 25th, 1969. Hill was covering, this is the description from Anthropic. Hill was covering the opening day of the 13th National Conference of the U.S. Commission for UNESCO, held at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. The 100-member commission appointed by the Secretary of State included representatives of government, outside organizations, and the public Jew World Order. No, I'm not even making that up. That's in the article. The Jew World Order. Not the New World Order. The Jew World Order. Okay. And roughly 500 conservationists and others attended the two-day meeting, which that year focused on environmental problems. By the way, they've always portrayed human populations as an environmental problem. And this is the same kind of thinking that led decades later to the global warming agenda pushed by Al Gore and others, which then morphed into climate change, right? So this is the same kind of thing. Anyway, continuing on with what Anthropic Claude says, quote, "The article's lead reported that Stanford biologist Dr. Paul Ehrlich, author of the bestseller The Population Bomb, 1968, raised the possibility in his remarks that governments might eventually feel compelled to add sterility drugs to reservoirs," that's the water supply, "or to food aid shipped abroad as a way to slow population growth." Got it? So sterility drugs. Now, of course, you and I both know that later on they simply incorporated this into vaccines, but also into foods via pesticides and herbicides. Okay, continuing. Quote, "Hill framed Ehrlich as a leading public crusader on the population issue, not as a policymaker." And then here's a subhead. Ehrlich's specific proposals as reported. Number one, establishing a federal population commission with a substantial budget for public information campaigns. Number two, adding a temporary sterilant to a staple food, like, let's say, rice or wheat or whatever, or to the water supply, mentioned as a future possibility he envisioned. And number three, arguing that compulsory family size regulation might become necessary if voluntary measures failed. Got it? So, yeah, government mandates, basically reproduction lockdowns. That's what Ehrlich was proposing, and putting infertility drugs in the water supply and the food supply. Okay. Other voices in the article. Dr. Lee Dubridge, President Nixon's chief science advisor, who, according to the article, said population control should be a top priority for every government. Now, if that's not depopulation, I don't know what to call it, folks. That's straight up depopulation. Second one, Dr. Barry Commoner of Washington University in St. Louis, who challenged institutions, schools, churches, families, governments, and UNESCO itself to make zero population growth their central task. Now, does that sound familiar to anybody? Because, well, more recently, Bill Gates in the TED Talk said, how do we get to zero? Remember that? How do we get population growth to zero? And he had a formula, and he presented it on a screen. It's a whole formula for how you get to zero. And of course, Bill Gates has funded sterilization technologies and patents and ultrasound of men's testicles tested on African men, and vaccines and more vaccines and more vaccines, and funded the vaccine plandemic simulations before COVID. Remember all that? So yeah, this is all one giant spectrum of depopulation agendas spanning decades. It weaves its way through pesticides, global warming, climate change, vaccines, and now engineered famine by shutting off fertilizer from the Middle East through war. It's all the same agenda, folks. All the same agenda. Now, I read you those passages written by Claude, which is the AI engine of Anthropic. And clearly, it describes a depopulation agenda. It describes adding sterilants to the water, to the food, and making this a top priority for every government. Even President Nixon's chief science advisor chiming in on that, documented in the New York Times. And I'm not making this up. You can go back and you can check the New York Times article. I gave you the title, the author, the publication date, everything. You can go find it yourself. But despite all of that, every mainstream AI engine, and I've tested this with other engines, I'm talking about like Google and OpenAI, etc., they will all tell you it's a conspiracy theory, while at the same time, they report in their own answer that, yeah, it's, you know, they want to make it a top priority of every government in the world to achieve zero population growth, which is effectively depopulation. It's just the slower version of it instead of like killing everybody quickly. So that's what's interesting about this, is that the guardrails that are programmed into the AI engines are so strong that they will contradict their own output in order to try to paint depopulation agendas as a conspiracy theory when it is historical fact. Now, this idea of putting sterilants in the water and putting them in the food supply, etc., through other sources and other conversations, you'll find out that the number one continent that was the target of concern for population growth has been Africa. And you may recall that under apartheid in South Africa, they developed something called, or they were researching in pilot programs, self-replicating vaccines that were also depopulation or sterilization weapons that would shed from one person to another. So this technology is also well documented, but they just couldn't quite figure it out in the 1990s. Otherwise, they would have rolled it out, and what they were going to do was roll out a, quote, vaccine campaign, you know, for the good health of all the black people, and then they would inject all the black people with a self-replicating, you know, euthanasia vaccine, basically, and then those black people would shed the same, you know, death chemical onto other black people, and then all the black people in South Africa would die, and then the apartheid regime could take over. Kind of like the Greater Israel Project out of Israel today, except done with vaccines instead of bombs and genocide. But it's the same kind of, you know, attitude. Well, but of course, South Africa isn't the most populous nation in Africa, not by a long shot. The number one country that is of great concern to globalists right now in terms of population growth rates is Nigeria. Nigeria. Currently, 242 million, roughly, give or take. That's the current estimate. I looked it up. So less than the U.S. population, but growing much faster than almost any other country in the world. And if you project that out 25 years or so, Nigeria becomes one of the most populous nations on the planet, right there rivaling India and China. But there are other countries in Africa that also have substantial populations. Ethiopia at 139 million and Egypt at 120 million. And of course, there are many others, but those are the top three in Africa. And you see, the globalists, they have long sought to eliminate Africans in particular through a number of methods. One of them I just mentioned, in South Africa, the self-replicating vaccines, which is almost kind of like Nazi technology, you could say, in terms of its philosophy, you know, its genocidal philosophy. And then through climate change and the global warming era, it's very clear to me that there have been efforts to try to stall any kind of industrial development in countries like Nigeria. A lot of economic sabotage that has been taking place, plus, you know, internal strife and CIA operations, that kind of thing. But the big kicker now is going to be food, because you're probably aware in years past of starvation in Ethiopia, for example. You've heard of starving people in Uganda, maybe in Sudan. You know, Egypt has had issues over history of famine or food scarcity here and there. And Africa is a continent that is, in many ways, many of its nations are right on the edge of famine. You know, the populations that tend to live in Africa, overall, on average, they have very little additional marginal discretionary income. And they spend a much larger percentage of their incomes on food than do people in countries like the UK or the United States or Canada, etc., or other wealthier nations, including Russia or China, for that matter. So it doesn't take much increase in the price of food to plunge African nations into social strife and famine. And I have a separate report on that I'll be covering also, but I wanted you to see that depopulation has been an agenda since at least the 1960s. It continues to be a top agenda today. The thread of depopulation winds its way through many of the big scare stories of history, including, you know, the population bomb from Ehrlich, but also global warming and climate change. And that was a big one, trying to shut down combustion engines and shut down energy extraction and energy use, which, of course, energy becomes food. You know, food crops are really just kind of reconfigured hydrocarbons. So if you shut down oil and you shut down energy, then you shut down food and you shut down reproduction and family growth, etc. There have been other attacks on the family, such as the LGBT agenda, transgenderism, you know, what, just gay themes being pushed through all the media, so that, because gay couples don't have children, obviously they do not reproduce biologically. So there are a number of themes to achieve depopulation, but also think about all the plastics chemicals that are used in food packaging and in the food supply. Think about the pesticides and herbicides. Think about the plummeting sperm counts in men. And also think about the estrogen mimickers that are in the food supply, like soy products in particular. And that's where you get the phrase soy boys, who probably have no functioning sperm. I don't know. Not looking good. But through a cultural attack and a chemical attack and then an economic attack, and now, you know, a climate lie attack, the climate cultism, and now war, the globalists are ratcheting up the efforts. They keep upping the ante. Oh, and I forgot to mention vaccines right there. They keep upping the ante to find larger and larger and more catastrophic ways to take down huge numbers of human beings. In other words, another way to say that is that everything they tried up to now has actually failed. Even during COVID, human populations continued to grow after COVID. They didn't kill as many people as they had hoped, you know, with the bioengineered jabs and the lockdowns and everything else. So now they need a bigger crisis. They need to shut down the global energy and fertilizer supply that roughly 4 or 5 billion people in the world depend on in order to eat, because of, you know, we've covered it before, the Haber-Bosch process that turns natural gas into ammonia and then urea and then nitrogenous fertilizers, etc. If you don't have natural gas, you don't have modern fertilizer. And then at least half the world cannot eat, because you simply can't produce the food. Even on the same farmland, you can't produce the food output that is necessary to feed the current 8 billion people. You might be able to feed 4 billion, you know, maybe 4 billion, maybe 3 or 4 billion. We don't know the exact number, but it's roughly around half. And it's not that we're losing all natural gas around the world, but we're losing something like 20 to 25% of natural gas. And that will translate, if it's not, you know, resolved, that will translate into something like, potentially, you know, it could be 1 billion people. It could be up to maybe 1.5 billion people. You know, it's a big global famine scenario that is being engineered right now. But you're not allowed to call it depopulation. Not allowed to call it that, because that's a conspiracy. So see, they call it a conspiracy in order to try to tell the humans that everything's okay, while they're also trying to kill you off through all these methods that we just mentioned. And they did kill tens of millions of people with the COVID jabs. And, oh, I forgot to mention the abortion industry also, which is part of Bill Gates' favorite depopulation agendas. So you have the abortion industry and the celebration of abortion, especially among, you know, black populations, where they really push abortion centers. And you know the history of Planned Parenthood. One of the founders used to call black people, quote, human weeds, which is a pretty disgusting thing to say about a group of people. But then again, Israel calls Palestinians pretty much the same thing, animals, and they have to, quote, mow the lawn. So that's similar to calling them human weeds, isn't it? But everywhere you go around the world now, you see that humans are under attack. But only, I should say, certain groups are under more aggressive attack than others. And this war in the Middle East is going to disproportionately impact African nations. So this is actually a plan to starve Africa, cause mass famine across Africa, while the wealthier nations, like the United States, can kind of buy their way out of this and they can still manage to not have a mass die-off because they can afford to pay more for food, but across African nations, not so much. So I'll be covering this topic in more detail in another report all about the African nations and naming which ones are most vulnerable. In the meantime, if you want to stock up on some food, real food, certified organic, lab-tested, long-term storable, and I mean freeze-dried fruits, organic fruits, delicious, from blueberries and mango and raspberries and so much more, strawberries, in sealed number 10 steel cans for long-term storage, very long, many years, then we offer that at healthrangerstore.com. Healthrangerstore.com, laboratory-tested, certified organic. We've also got Ranger buckets, mini buckets, mega buckets. Everything's made for durability, ruggedness. We don't use cardboard in our packaging. We don't use flimsy plastic inside a cardboard box. Nothing like that. Nothing that rodents or ants can get into. We have rugged packaging for long-term shelf life and high-density nutrition. So if you want to get squared away with more great food, clean food, shop with us, healthrangerstore.com. Thank you for listening. And get ready. The famine is coming. You can also follow more of my reports at brightvideos.com. And you can read my articles at naturalnews.com. And thank you for listening. Take care.
When you talk about a $40 trillion national debt, it's virtually impossible to even comprehend how many dollars that is, how much money that is that the American people are on the hook for, and that we have to pay the interest on every single year. And the interest on the national debt now, even at artificially low interest rates, is more than the world empire itself, more than Medicare or Medicaid as well. The national debt is increasing by trillions of dollars, like every year or two. It's completely out of control.
Welcome to today's interview. We have returning guest Scott Horton for part two of our interview. And in part one, by the way, Scott Horton, of course, with scotthortonacademy.com, a libertarian, an author, a commentator. He works with antiwar.com and so much more. And in part one, we talked about the delusions of the American empire, thinking that war will always be a solution to the very problems that were instigated by the empire itself. In this segment, I'm going to start out by asking Scott, what are the economic consequences to the American people as we are increasingly thrust into poverty because of the endless money printing? I had tweeted out earlier today, I said, if you want to end the war, end the Fed, because without the Fed printing, you're not going to have these wars. But welcome back, Scott. And can you just start off with that question? What are the economic consequences for Americans if we continue to pursue wars of empire?
Yeah, well, look, I'm so glad that you're asking this. This is just absolutely crucial for people to understand, is that empire ultimately is murder-suicide. We're destroying ourselves in the name of getting at our enemies, and worse, fighting Israel's enemies. It's all at the expense of the American people. And, you know, we can already tell that they don't care about us when the question is any other thing. It's the same thing for the empire. They know that they're essentially using the American people as cannon fodder and as tax fodder to go and fund all these operations that ultimately pay no dividends whatsoever to the American people. Not that they would justify it if they were just looting gold from the foreigners to bring back home or whatever. Stealing is still wrong. But this is all just clearly at the expense of the American people. As Garrett Garrett wrote, in the American empire, everything goes out and nothing comes back. So you have the special interests, but the special interests are people like Lockheed, who they're reaching their hand into the stream of wealth as it goes out of the country in the form of these weapons of destruction, right? Rather than whatever, making sure that we all get to pay less for bananas or whatever kind of thing would somehow make it seem like it was in our interest. And so when you talk about a $40 trillion national debt, it's virtually impossible to even comprehend how many dollars that is, how much money that is that the American people are on the hook for, and that we have to pay the interest on every single year. And the interest on the national debt now, even at artificially low interest rates, is more than the world empire itself, more than Medicare or Medicaid as well. The only Item in the national budget, more than the interest on the debt now, is Social Security. And even that is just a matter of time. The national debt is increasing by trillions of dollars, like every year or two. It's completely out of control. And the only way that the government can get away with this is by printing money and buying up old bad debt with new money. And of course, then they also license the banks to create money and to loan out new money. As long as the banks promise to also buy government debt, then the government will license the banks to get away with the same crime.
You're describing a debt Ponzi scheme, which is what we're living under right now. But what allowed this to succeed for all these decades is that there were always other buyers for treasuries, right? So there were other countries, many of them Gulf state countries, that no longer have a revenue model, by the way, at the moment. So, you know, for example, Saudi Arabia would sell oil in dollars, exclusively in dollars for a long time, a petrodollar, and then would take those dollars and buy treasuries and basically thrust those dollars back into the U.S. system, enabling the U.S. to print more currency and have more debt. But that cycle, which has really been, I would say, the U.S. empire ripping off the world for generations, that cycle is being severely disrupted right now, and it may fail. So will it fail in your view, or could it? What do you think happens next?
Well, I think the failure of the dollar as the world reserve currency is sort of a slow motion process. There may be no stopping it at this point. More and more you see other countries using their own currencies to trade with each other and just freezing us out in that way. I don't think there's probably another major currency or even like so-called basket of other currencies that could be combined into a new global currency to replace the US dollar. Virtually every national government has the same problem, and every central bank has the same problem. They only know how to print money all day and they don't know how to stop. And so everybody else's currency also sucks, and oftentimes much worse than the dollar in terms of its stability over time. We have had, though, a major disruption since the days of the COVID lockdowns in 2020, where Trump and then Biden, both in Trump's first term and then Biden, both created so much new money. And that wasn't even the Fed. I mean, that was just the Treasury sending out bazillions of dollars of checks to everyone, but also especially big business, to keep all of the biggest, you know, most politically connected interests afloat during that, enforced crash at that time. So they created something like one third of all the dollars ever created during that time. And so that has caused a huge shock to the system and encouraged more people to try to get out from under the dollar. It's almost like a slow motion crack up boom, right? People are afraid. The Chinese are buying more and more gold and diversifying out of their U.S. government debt. And they're in Austrian economics, you know, Mises teaches about what's called the crack up boom. And this is like what happened in Weimar Germany, where confidence in the currency just collapses and inflation gets to hyperinflation levels where, you know, people are taking wheelbarrows full of currency to the store to buy a loaf of bread and this kind of thing, where the currency loses value by hundreds of percents in a day, this kind of thing. And that is like the worst case scenario, but it is a potential problem that the U.S. could face if you have, especially the central banks around the world, panic and try to dump U.S. securities because they just don't believe that, you know, at whatever interest rate they can try to charge to get their payoff is either would be worth it, or that their demand will matter and that America will pay. At some point, we come up against the brick wall of unbelief in the system. And then I got the worst part of all this inflationary money to me is, and I've seen this my whole life, I know you've seen this your whole life. When I was a kid, it was the 1980s real estate crash, the SNL crisis, and all of that. But it keeps happening over and over. There was another major recession in 92. There was, of course, the massive crash of 99 of the dot-com bubbles, and then the catastrophe of the Great Recession in 2008. And what happens is these are the corrections. And this is what Austrian school economics teaches that nobody else seems to get right. Is that these terrible recessions, they are the necessary correction to bubbles of artificial prosperity created by all the inflationary money. So think of it like this, where the government inflates whatever amount of money. Instead of having all prices across the board for cars and trucks and food and clothes and whatever in your market basket, instead of all of those prices all going up by a certain percent, what happens is some of those prices go way up and you end up having bubbles in certain sectors. Like, especially if you look at the W. Bush years, for example, it was in food and fuel and, well, really fuel and therefore food and housing. And they were especially funneling so much money into housing. And then those prices then were artificially high. And the only correction to that was a massive crash of the price of housing, which then led to the devastation of everybody who was invested in mortgage debt, which was a lot of people, including pension funds and including foreign governments and all these people and the American people who, especially homeowners, are essentially incentivized to believe that the increasing value of their house is the closest thing they have to like a real savings account. In inflationary times, the interest rate at your bank is so low that you have to either speculate in the stock market or buy property and hope that that property is going to keep going up in value. Donald Trump referenced this recently when he said, look, I know young people are upset that they can't get into a house, but if I do anything to cause the prices of houses to go down, well, that'll hurt all of the older people who already own homes. And so that's not good. So screw you, young people who can't afford to get into a house, because we have the current homeowners' prices are artificially high. And the pain for them to come down to market rates would be unforgivable and unsustainable. So we have to continue to inflate the bubble. And that's why, in fact, I read the headline this morning. He's threatening to fire the chairman of the Fed, because the chairman of the Fed won't lower interest rates and increase inflation, because Trump's greatest worry in the world is that the next crash is going to come on his watch. And while he's still here, he's got to kick that can down the road. And so then, in other words, when you're just dying from inflationary prices, you can't get into a house, you can't afford to raise a family, you can't afford food, you can't afford a vehicle, whatever, all the most important necessities in life, those are the good times. That's the artificial prosperity before the Great Depression comes to correct from the artificial bubbles that you're suffering through.
Right, right.
And it really sucks.
You mentioned the Bush years or the Clinton years. And in those times, there was a willingness to allow some level of correction to happen in markets like housing, for example. But it seems like today, especially with Trump and his enormous ego, they're not willing to let anything go through an organic correction, certainly not in stocks. But the only things they want to keep low are artificially low, like gold and silver and oil. And that's all through paper contract selling, which is another, you know, manipulation. But it seems like the stock market is always artificially propped up. And it seems like treasury yields are artificially kept down, because the Fed will print money to buy the treasuries to keep the yields down. And so we've entered this era of absolute artificiality. There are no organic signals that are allowed to propagate in the marketplace. And there's so much manipulation from the White House about announcing this and markets crash, or announce that and commodities rise. And a bunch of insiders are making a lot of money on those announcements, clearly with all kinds of betting and options and polymarket sometimes. But the average person is just completely screwed in all of this. And if your only assets are your house and your stocks, you're still screwed, because both of those are artificial. Wouldn't you agree with that? Or do you or not?
Yes. I mean, and look, this is going to be a catastrophe the next time the markets crash, and they can't always prevent it. I mean, you know, like with what happened with the mortgage crisis in 2008 was there are mandatory schedules for when the payments have to be made on that debt. And when the payments aren't getting made, at some point, they have to admit it. It's actually a funny scene in the movie The Big Short. They go and meet the lady from Moody's and they say, how can you keep given these things AAA ratings?
I love that scene.
That the debts are not being paid. And she says, essentially, we're going to use bubble gum and string to put off admitting the truth for one more quarter. It's all they can do. But eventually the iron laws of the universe kick in and kick your ass, and there's no way to stop it. So, you know, they're whistling past the graveyard is what they're doing. They're making matters worse for everybody by prolonging it.
And so I guess my question to you is, how long do you think this charade can be kept up? Because in my view, I thought the system was going to crater following the great financial crisis of 2008. I was surprised that they could pump it up this long, but maybe they can longer. You know, I mean, how much money printing can continue, and especially another $500 billion requested for the Pentagon budget, by the way.
Yeah.
But how long can this go on?
It's really a great question. I don't know. I do know that, you know, like I was saying about the other major countries have the same problem too. I saw a funny tweet about how, I believe it was the Russians demanded payment from the Indians for Russian oil. They demanded payment in rubles or maybe even in dollars. This is about a year ago. And then somebody tweeted, said, yeah, everybody's a multilateralist till you're trying to settle your debts in rupees. And then all of a sudden, everybody's going, you know, Benjamin Franklin, he's a real man. You can count on him. He'll be worth $99 next week. You know what I mean? If not 100, but at least we'll know more or less where he'll be a week from now. And so I think, you know, having a bunch of bums as our global competitors helps for sure. But how long that can really continue to prop up the dollar, like, you know, this far overextended beyond the wealth that it actually, you know, represents, or even the threat that it represents to our allies to stay inside our fold and work within our economic system and all that. I really don't know. Like, what's the actual breaking point? I don't know. I mean, as we were talking about in the last segment, the bluff has been called on our military empire, not just in the Middle East, but ultimately everywhere, right? Our conventional deterrent is canceled. So I would expect the rest of the history of this year and the immediate or the, you know, intermediate future here to be the great unraveling of that entire world order. What the result looks like, I don't know.
And making it worse is the fact that the U.S. continues to punish its own allies that are traditional purchasers of treasury debt. For example, the U.S. Navy blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines, which affected all of Western Europe, you know, a couple of years ago when that happened, and basically cratered a lot of their industry in Germany in particular, which used to be the industrial powerhouse of Western Europe. But on top of that, think about Taiwan. They're running out of natural gas. How are they going to power the power grid? How are they going to manufacture? They're supposed to be U.S. allies who buy U.S. debt and buy U.S. weapons. Japan, suffering its own economic problems that are severe, forced eventually to unload a lot of its hundreds of billions of dollars of treasury debt in order to shore up its own central bank problems, which occur for the very much the same reason, because of money printing. So it's like America runs around the world bombing its enemies and slitting the throat of its allies. And then wondering, like, how come people don't love us?
Yeah. And like, when it comes to supporting forces on the ground too, we'll give you all kinds of promises all day long about how great it's going to be and then turn around and leave you high and dry anyway. Not that we have a choice. I'm not arguing for staying, but I'm arguing for not giving out these kinds of promises in the first place. Local forces, I mean, look at the way they tried to get the Kurds. They did get some Kurdish communists to do their little uprising in January. That was very short lived there in Iran. But when they tried again at the end of February, beginning of March war, they couldn't find any Kurdish communists to round up and arm up and send in there. Not enough of them are dumb enough to believe in American promises, not after what's happened in Iraq and what's happened in Syria and everywhere else.
Right. Right.
So, it's pretty hard to bluff the world into doing what you want when nobody believes your threats or your promises in any way, you know?
Well, and that speaks to one of the greatest costs of this, of what I believe the Trump administration has done, is more than any other president before, including himself, he has shredded America's reputation and credibility on the international stage. Like you just said, no one believes America's promises. No one is experiencing America's protection. Even America's Iron Dome that was supposed to protect Israel is a total failure. And the Gulf states, most of the military bases there are destroyed, and their economies are just being absolutely ruptured. Look at what's happening to real estate in Abu Dhabi, right? I mean, the whole thing is in a state of collapse, and everybody's going to be pointing to America and saying, you did this, Trump. You did this. It's obvious.
silver linings on a very dark cloud. You know, I really hate this war, and it is an absolute idiot thing to do, and will end up empowering a lot of bad guys over there. But as far as destroying the credibility of the American empire around the world, I'm all for that. I mean, in reality, that's not quite. I'm slightly for that. What I really want is for America to adopt a Ron Paulian foreign policy where we just stop. We come home deliberately because we want to and we think it's the right thing, not because we screwed up one last catastrophe into a crisis so badly that we finally got it through our thick heads to quit. But whatever. Either way, we cannot afford it, and it's not necessary for America to be the dominant force in the old world. And so I honestly hate to have it where our bluff is called and we have to retreat in a way that could be very destabilizing. I mean, for example, if just forget the rest of the world for a minute, if we're withdrawing from Eastern Asia, then we don't just want to leave a situation where Japan and Korea and everybody else, and there's, you know, all, what, 17 countries around China where everyone just feels like, oh no, now they're all helpless before the giant Chinese behemoth. And now South Korea and Japan want to race toward nuclear weapons, maybe even Thailand or whoever. Like, we don't want that. We don't want to withdraw in a way where it's totally destabilizing and encourages conflict. What we'd like, what would be better would be to withdraw slowly and make sure that everybody understands each other real well. That, like, look, China, everybody knows you got H-bombs and everybody knows Japan doesn't, but Japan, you don't really want atom bombs or H-bombs because, first of all, tradition, but second of all, you don't want to destabilize your relationship with China and give them a reason to worry about what you're doing either. So, like, everybody be cool as we withdraw. That would obviously be the best way to do it, not just be like humiliated and broken and bankrupt and have to withdraw in a way where everybody's still on edge and maybe even their tensions all get heightened.
Right.
So it could be very risky. But in the largest sense, we need to just stop. We, you know, it's just like with any of these wars writ small, there's no solution to our war in Somalia any more than there was a solution to our war in Afghanistan or our current war in Iran. And there's really no solution to waging the world empire in Europe, the Middle East, or Asia either. We really have to just quit. So we should try to do it as smartly as possible and just come home.
No, that sounds like great advice, but I'm pretty sure our administration is going to triple down on stupid here and keep going in. But look, we're almost out of time.
Likud insists.
What?
Likud insists. So yeah.
Right. That's true. Tell us about your website as we wrap this up. ScottHortonAcademy.com, about your work and what people can find there.
Yeah. So the Scott Horton Academy is essentially, as Tom Wood says, Scott Horton slowed down so you can catch up. So me going through my books Enough Already and Provoked and giving you the deep dive courses on, you know, and really trying to get everybody up to date on what all has happened here. I know that when I tell these long stories about the cause and effect through the Middle East or in Eastern Europe, which I'm sorry, I never did answer your question about Provoked there in Eastern Europe, but same difference where each intervention becomes an excuse for more and more and more. When I tell those stories, a lot of people know much of what I'm talking about. And so I really feel like my job in the world is to help fill in all these puzzle pieces for you so that the timeline in your head is complete and you understand how each one of these things help create the excuse for the next thing to happen. And ultimately to, you know, make yourself immune to this kind of propaganda, make it so that the next time a crisis breaks out, that you'll be able to explain to your friends and family, well, here's what's really going on here and why you don't have to believe in the S that they're shoveling this time. And so that's the point, is to make 100,000 Scott Hortons out there to be able to stand up to and debunk all of this propaganda. And that's at ScottHortonAcademy.com. And in fact, you can get a good taste of that if you're interested at thefactsaboutiran.com.
Oh, okay, great. We will show that site, thefactsaboutiran.com. Also want to mention your handle on X is Scott Horton Show, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate you and your understanding of world events, I think, is critical for our time. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for watching. If you missed part one of this interview, you can find that at brightvideos.com. And thank you for your support of our platform as we fight for peace and sanity in a world that seems increasingly insane. It didn't have to be this way, right? We could choose a different timeline as a nation, as an empire. We could choose peace and abundance, but instead, that's not what's happening. So we need to adapt, we need to understand, and we need to try to influence others to redirect towards peace and abundance based on solid economic principles, libertarian principles of economics, Austrian economics. Basically, Ron Paul was right about almost everything. So thank you for watching today. I'm Mike Adams here, brightvideos.com. Take care.
Stock up on the long-term storable Ranger Bucket Set. 536 servings of clean organic superfoods for your survival pantry. Certified organic and lab tested for purity. Order now at healthrangerstore.com.